Jack Mitchell and fellow students. I'm not going to deal with the subject this morning as a mere academic curiosity, but as something which may be of interest in ethnology, but of no practical value. I shall deal with it as something, let us say, as truth, probably. And as something that will make a difference if one determines. How about that echo? Something that will make a difference if one. Or even choose life with a view to the possible reality of more than one existence in a body. I admit firsthand that it is impossible to prove to the mind the reality of reincarnation in the sense of mathematical proof, or in the sense of ordinary scientific proof. For proof would require the action of other organs of cognition than those of sense, perception, and conceptual cognition. But actually, as a fact of life, we do live upon the basis of working assumptions that make a lot of difference to us. Now I'm going to start by presenting a problem of rigorous cognition. Do I know, for instance, that this organism of mine was ever born? I have to admit that I do not. To be sure, I've been told that it was born, but I remember no such event. There is, I admit, some reason to doubt, therefore, that it ever was born, as a matter of logical rigor. Also, am I sure that you, who appear to be before me, are actual independent existences and not unconscious suggestions from my unconscious? Actually, as a matter of rigor, I do not know that you are such independent existences and not merely ideas in my mind. However, I find it pragmatically convenient to assume that you are independent existences. Things work a little better, and I find myself not so lonely as I would be if you are only ideas in my mind. And the same goes for the assumption that this organism of mine was born. I have been told that it was, but that is only just I have heard. Now, I have not witnessed the event. I have not experienced it. I have not traced it out by subjective analysis. Nonetheless, it appears that being born is a characteristic of these organisms. Or it so happens I never saw it happen. I've merely been told that it happened. And I've seen creatures small and getting bigger. So it is a convenient working hypothesis that these organisms are born, and that therefore this organism which I carry around with me was also born. It is a convenient, pragmatic assumption. There's no rigor there. I'll admit, on the basis of rigor, we cannot prove reincarnation. But neither can any one of you prove that he was born. Nor can you prove to my satisfaction that you're not, that you're anything more than I did in my mind. That's a touch of solipsism. Schopenhauer said concerning it once, it's on the floor. But we'll disregard it. We won't try to take that thought in our philosophy. We'll just go around. So, we'll just go around the solid hypothesis, and we will assume the birth of organism is a fact. Now, there's hardly greater uncertainty as to the existence of multiple births for a given entity. Let us consider certain indirect considerations. I find that I have a faith or prejudice, if you will, that this universe, that this existence that surrounds it, is such that if I put questions to it, I can get reasonable answers. That is the untrue assumption and faith of every scientist. We can conceive that an existence might be wholly irrational, that it had no order, and that there would be no meaningless answer derived from it for any question to put to it. But I find that I have, as an article of innate faith, a certain assurance that it is possible to get answers to questions that are reasonably acceptable, that are understandable. And because of that faith, we have science and philosophy. I also have another thing. That there is analogous to the principle of reason, the quality of justice in the existence. That which happens to creatures is not wholly arbitrary. That there is an order, a law, not only on the level of things, but on the level of morality in the deepest sense. And that this world, however much it may appear to the contrary, is at base reasonable and just. Yet, I look abroad upon the facts of life as I see them within the limited range of one life. I see creatures that are born to lives of suffering and others born to lives of comfort and opportunity. Are these the wayward results of an arbitrary, of the diets of an arbitrary God? That assumption would violate the basic faith that this existence is reasonable and just. But if I have lived before and I have acted and thought and willed wisely or unwisely, generously or selfishly, compassionately or cruelly, and then I realize that is the natural consequence of such living in the past, then I can see how this difference of circumstance apparent now belongs to an ordered whole. I may not be able yet to trace the background of causal connection that led to the result now, but I have a conception that enormously favors my basic faith that the existence is truth, is just and reasonable. And as a result, I feel at home in this world. I feel that I can trust its central core. And then I'm not passing through a meaningless arbitrariness. I don't intend to give more concerning evidences favoring the conception of reincarnation. And bear in mind, it must be combined with the companion conception of law, which is commonly known by the Eastern term karma. But bear in mind, it is simply the law of equilibrium, a principle universally God, the great law that maintains the stars in their courses and equally the electrons in theirs, and the courses of all creatures in the ranges between, so that at no moment is there ever a violation of this fundamental equilibrium. Karma is merely the law of equilibrium spread out in time. And because of this law, and only because of it, can we put questions to nature and expect reasonable, understandable answers. Now, as a matter of social fact, there are two primary contrasting religious attitudes concerning the problem of immortality. Is man an immortal being? Well, there is a sense in which I can say right off he is not. In the sense that he is a complex of organized consciousness. she is not. But in a deeper sense, and this can be verified, and I have verified, in the sense of pure, unordinary, underivative consciousness, he is neither born nor does he ever die. And this can be known, for there are realizations that reach above space, time, and love to the root from whence these spring. And to know that I eternally abide there, not this person, I, but the I, the self, that is present and reflected in each and every one here and everything, is eternally abiding in that timeless state. And what is timeless is neither born, nor does it ever cease to exist. This certainty can be known. And every mystic who has gone far has testified to that realization. It is not simply a matter of faith. Faith may lead you to the search, but it can become the root to certain knowledge, not conceptual knowledge. Not perceptual knowledge of the senses, but that deeper knowledge through identity. But that which becomes also dies. And that's the other side of the picture. It may not die soon. It may die long since. When it dies, it may be a matter of achievement on the part of the individual, or failure to achieve. But that which becomes also becomes not. So when I lay down here a general principle, it does not mean that consciousness is no more. Organized consciousness, I mean now, is no more than that which is associated with these gross animal bodies that we are. So there is the enormous interest, whether I transcend in the sense of being an individual, the span of this embodied life. We find the conviction that this is so widely spread among mankind. It's almost the reason for the religions of the world. For if all we had was an ephemeral appearance in a gross animal body, and then a dive into darkness beyond, there would not be any real religious reason for a religious discipline or a religious belief or practice. There would be no real reason for taking anything whatsoever seriously, other than the satisfying of the animal needs of the body. You think it through. That's what all you would have. There is this deep faith, or shall we say, intuition, that the dropping of this gross animal body is not the end of things. Now there are two approaches to how this can be. The one is the traditional approach of Christendom, not here a teaching of Christ, but something worked up by the theological speculators who followed. And there is, in contrast, the point of view fundamental in India and much of the rest of the Orient, in the Christian tradition, apparently our forefathers were pretty radical materialists. And I discovered this, I was really quite shocked. They actually could not conceive of a vehicle of organized consciousness that was not sensible to the gross senses. So they had to handle the problem by imagining some way that though a body is seen to die, it can be raised up again. And that fantastic conception was superimposed upon the death of Christ and his resurrection. That because he, in a unique sense, is supposed to be God, not in the philosophic sense, that every piece is part and parcel of God, but in a unique sense. And that because he died and raised himself from the dead, therefore a paradigm was established whereby through blind faith, one could die and later that body that died would be resurrected again at the final judgment. And thus you could achieve a continuum of organized consciousness. Way back in my days when I was a teenager, and I saw some difficulties in this conception. Much to my surprise, our local minister actually believes in the literal resurrection of the body. Well, the picture that I have is quite impressive. We know that animal bodies decay, and that the bones last the longest. And I get a picture of a resurrection where a lot of graves are opening up and a lot of skeletons coming out and dancing. What is the trouble with Christian theologians? They got us into a mess like that. We just have to throw other better reasons overboard to be able to believe a thing like that. We have to throw overboard the whole conception of an intelligible order behind this existence. But actually, men today believe that. Father Victor writes in his book, God and the Unconscious, the man who worked close with Dr. Young, and is very broad on the whole, approvingly speaks of this as Christian materialism. I think that part of the trouble goes out of the occasion when the Christian theologian threw overboard an orientation to Plato and replaced Plato with Aristotle as the recognized philosopher. And among Aristotle's works is the De Anima, in which he propounds the doctrine of a psychosomatic unity in a radical sense. There is no mind without body, no psyche without body. If therefore the body falls, the psyche falls. I went to my minister, I thought this out. I said to him, we know that when a body falls, it disintegrates. And we know that the molecules or atoms of that body are taken up by other living organisms. And we know that if it's a vegetable, for instance, animal creatures may come along and eat that. And when the animal creature dies, it may be in him. Or it may be eaten by him, another human. And it so happened that certain of those atoms that were in the original body are also in the body of the last human when he dies. So I said to the clergyman, to which individual do these atoms belong in the resurrection? He said, leave it to the Lord, my son. I broke with the church then. Now, on the other hand, from the audience, let us see how the conception of karma and reincarnation fits in to the deeper conception that man is an evolving being. Not alone in the sense of a stream of evolution that builds functions and so forth to meet the environment and so on, not alone in the sense of the Darwinian natural selection, but in the sense of a purpose, an objective, a function that can be found as a reason for it. And further, that this evolution reaches a point, indeed, the point where the creature becomes human, where he persists as an individual, not simply as a life stream through species. And then consider further that the building of qualities, of building the resources of a mind, for instance, and the rest of what makes up the total human being, is an enormous task, taking an enormous time, something that could not be accomplished in the limited span of a possible 70 to 100 years of a reasonably long life. There is a conception of reincarnation and karma. There now is no difficulty, for one would then evolve step by step through karma led to correct errors, false building and so on, and encouraging true building, until finally he emerges as a brilliant mind, or as a brilliant soul, the being of compassion, such as a Buddha. This becomes intelligible, conceivable, something that doesn't violate our sense of order. If we predicate a fact of a rhythmical birth leading to after death state and rebirth and so on until a certain goal is reached. That's right. And however, there are those, this has happened in the Orient, and this is where the Orient is going to be, who have tended to view the pattern of birth and death as merely a meaningless joke that has no purpose. This is not the universe. It's not the profoundest reason, but it does exist. And the whole purpose of the religious or yogic discipline is to escape from an endless concatenation of psychical processes that have become very real. But I'd say quite otherwise, and I speak here in agreement with what Sri Aurobindo himself said. There is a recognizable purpose. This is what? Actually, it will be part of the material that I'll be taking up next hour. I don't know whether any of you want to or will be allowed to come in where that next hour will be, but we'll suggest something of the answer to the question, is there a reason for this long travail, for in this world it is more travail than delight. Is there a reason for it all? Does it lead to something? Now, what is it that reincarnates? And here is where many who are convinced of the reality of reincarnation have made a serious error. It is not this human personality we see now. It is something that bears a karmic relationship to this human personality. And I'll illustrate a possible way. You may be familiar with Dr. Jung's psychological type and his four functions, psychological functions. And of the fact that in any incarnation we tend to accentuate certain functions and repress others. We might, say, be born as an introverted, intuitive thinking type, repressing feelings, sensations. Intuition tends to the development of intuition tends to the repression of sensation. Development of thinking tends to the repression of feeling. In that given life, feeling and sensation were repressed, did not develop. And part of her goal of being a rounded, complete individual. A subsequent incarnation, very likely, perhaps the very next, would be one in which the feeling and sensational function and the extroverted attitude had representation. In the end, the rounded man is fully four functions and has both attitudes and has them in his command. He can turn the word introversion into and extroversion into verb. an introvert and extrovert at will. That is when he has reached the mind. When he wishes to penetrate into subjective depth, he introverts. When he wishes to act externally, he extroverts. He is not now the victim of his nature, but master of it. And so with the four functions and their interrelationship, you'll be able to shift from one to the other, giving to each its due. But this is a position arrived at after many lifetimes of endeavor. No, it is not this particular personality that is born again. You've got to have a deeper conception that the real entity, the real bearer of the personality and of the consciousness, is not visible to other consciousness, but persists in a subtle inner domain, visible to the properly developed second sight, but not to grow sense. And that this being, during an incarnation, sends forth a ray into incarnation. And when that incarnation is finished, withdraws the ray, and in the next incarnation sends out another ray. I call this the pseudopodal theory of reincarnation, based upon the figure of the amoeba, the one-celled organism that manages to crawl by projecting portions of itself outward and pulling itself forward, then projecting another portion of itself outward and pulling itself forward, or in whatever way it wanted to go. These bodies, these forms that we see, are to be thought of as merely pseudopods of the real entity which we are. And that when one pseudopod is withdrawn with what it has garnered of wisdom and love and knowledge and other forms of experience, and brought its contribution to the general story of the entity which we really are, then again, another pseudopod is sent forth, or another race, which becomes another personality. Karmically, the child of all those rays that have gone before, karmically conditioned by those rays, but not identified with any one of those rays. Bear this in mind if you ever read the Buddhist sutras that give Dharma Buddha's instruction on this subject. Where he says, that which follows is like a candle, which is the natural karmic result of the candle which is this light. The candle representing the aggregate. And those aggregates, which have been thrown back and dissolved and reintegrated, again form a new candle. And you have a light on this candle and a light on that candle. And since they are like size, the flame looks alike. Are the flames the same? In one sense, he says, they are. And in another sense, they are not. They are, in the sense of a continuum unseen behind the veil. They are not, in the sense that the appearances of that continuum as personalities out here are not reincarnations of each other. There is a point when many believe reincarnation are in error. Now in the long journey to the ultimate fulfillment, there will come a time when that entity which we in reality are have been building through the ages will be in God. And there will be what is called the great sleep, the great time of rest, which is not non-consciousness. But it is consciousness, not just one. A consciousness which in the beginning we could not distinguish from unconsciousness. But because of this journey through life after life, we have become strong to become conscious of consciousness without the aid of any phenomena. And then that which was absolute unconscious becomes absolute conscious. Now this is a brief of time. The time is up now, and my watch is still along. So that'll be the end of it for the time being. Thank you.